Session number 9234.
Mr. McFarker, Reel 3. During this period, whilst you were in Spain, was it then that you became involved with this question of the smuggling of people out of the embassies?
Yes, it was a minor incident, really, because it was the best solution to that problem. It saved a lot of bloodshed, and it saved a great deal of unfriendly propaganda abroad, which would have done the Spanish Republican cause no good. And so therefore it was a satisfactory solution to the problem of these people that were hiding in the various embassies and in various friends' houses in Madrid, of which General, what was his name, Catala, General something or other, who talked about his fifth column in Madrid, was so sure they would be responding to an uprising if they got there, which of course they weren't able to do, largely because by that time the Republic had organized a number of divisions, like the Campesinos, and there was another famous general too who also done so. And do not let us forget the fact that quite a lot of the Spanish Republican officers were loyal to the Republic and served in the Republican army and organized the redevelopment of that army.
Who was doing this smuggling of people out of the embassies?
They were taken out by, as far as I know, they were taken out by a large contingent were taken out by the Scottish Ambulance Unit down to Valencia, to be shipped across to Gibraltar and on to into Franco Spain.
Do you know how they were doing it? How they went about it?
They collected them around the embassies and took them down quite openly, as far as I can judge. And the Spanish government was quite glad to see them go, because had they been taken in Madrid, the populace would have been quite fearsome in their attitude to them. Because you'll recall that during all this time, they were shelling Madrid. And I've stood in the central plaza in Madrid and shells dropping and seen passerbys being killed. I picked up a child of 2 or 3 years old who'd got a shell splinter in its thumb. And there was a hospital just across the square, and I rushed across with it to the operating room. And they took the child, but they just, when they stripped it off, they had this splinter in his stomach. He just wouldn't live. And there was this type of incident going on every day of the week. And there was also, of course, the shortage of food. The Republic was doing its very best to supply a ration of food to all. And of course they had instituted a campaign in the countryside to grow more and more food. And there were tremendous, they enlisted the artists and newspaper people in preparing graphic pictures of encouraging people to grow more food, because many of them, of course, couldn't read or write. And these pictures were the propaganda vehicle which was used instead to stimulate both the spirit and the purpose of the Spanish people. And it was extremely effective.
Did you go to any political meetings in Madrid?
No. Went to I would hesitate to say there were no political meetings, but there I wouldn't have said there were very many political meetings. Any meetings that took place were took place within the jurisdiction of any organizations, political organizations, hospitals and so forth, where the pep talks were and discussions took place. And then, of course, we were also available to us were the papers, the European papers, all languages of papers. And these, and then there was, at that time, of course, you remember the Left Book Camp was very strong, and books were coming out every month from various writers on the current political situation as it was developing. And it was developing with great speed. And so many of us became very politically conscious in those kind of days. I was by that time I was a member of the Labour Party. I was a member of my trade union. And I was asked to join the Communist Party in Spain. And I refused to do so. I said, this is not the place for me to join the Communist Party. I said, I'll do my duty here. I'll do whatever I'm called upon to do. But I will not join the Communist Party at the moment. And nobody pressed me to do so.
Who was it who asked you?
Oh, I can't remember who asked me to do it, but there were various people I suggested I should.
Somebody from the International Brigade, you mean?
Yes, well, there was a man who died, actually, George Green, who was with whom I was very friendly. In fact, when we left the Scottish Ambulance Unit and joined the International Brigade, George was one of the first people I met. He was a celloist from London.
A what?
A celloist from London, a musician, who was a member of the Communist Party. His wife was Nan Green, who was secretary of the International Brigade, who died a year or so ago. And George, we arrived with virtually no clothes at all, because, and wisely, we handed back all our stuff to the ambulance unit. So we were clothed or semi-clothed, as it were. And I remember George diving into his kit bag and handed me a jersey and a shirt and all the rest of it. Well, he hadn't very much himself. And it's this kind of act of discipline and unity and comradeship that made a tremendous impression upon me and upon many people who went there who were not members of the Communist Party. In fact, I would have said a majority of them weren't members of the Communist Party at all. They were Democrats who were determined to give all they could to this struggle in Spain, which they realized was crucial to the whole future of peace in Europe. And they did so with great courage and a great belief in the unity of working people and in all working people, everybody, intellectuals and teachers and land workers and so forth. In Spain, of course, the majority of the workers realized that their chance of a better life and a more prosperous life and was dependent on the Democratic Republic surviving.
When was it that you decided to transfer to the International Brigade?
I think it was about sometime early in March 1937. I can't remember the exact date, but The crisis arrived when Miss Jacobson had come back to find that She was in such a fury about the fact that she was being refused passes to go to the front, and that only myself and George Barley and Morris Linden and the doctor were being offered these passes. And we said at that point, right, we no longer prepared to stay with you, and we're leaving. And she was in a great fury, of course, about, you can't go, you're British citizens, you're in my charge, and I'm not allowing you to go. And I said, you can't do anything about it. There was this kind of struggle went on, and all she intended to do, obviously, was to send us back to Britain with the word failure written over our chest, probably. And we, on the other hand, were very anxious to stay and help the Republic. But this time we were also infected by the general determination of the Spanish people. And so we said no. And she then attempted, this was in dark in Madrid when the shells and the bombers were out too, she insisted then that she would get the Spanish consul, who was the British representative there, a man by the name of Planelius, I've never forgotten him, to come and and as she thought, order us to remain in her charge. So we said we had no objection to Mr. Planelius coming, and Mr. Planelius came along. He was taken off out of a sick bed, poor man. And when he arrived, she explained to him what she wanted, order these men to stay and send them back to Britain. And he said, Miss Jacobson, he said, I have no powers of that kind. No powers whatsoever to do that. And she was furious. But she knew she was, as far as we were concerned, she had got no father. And then we walked out. We started walking out. Penelitius was standing at the door of the flat and said, gentlemen, I would like to wish you Godspeed. Which was very, very courageous of him too, because he didn't know, nor did we know, how long Madrid would stand at that point. And he said, I wish you good luck. And of course, it added to her fury as well. And that was when we went. And we crossed over, we went to Dr. Bethune's place. And he took us up to the International Brigade unit, and we were incorporated into that.
What exactly was Dr. Bethune's place?
Dr. Bethune was quite famous for, he pioneered the blood transfusion units on the front, on the battlefront. He was a Canadian, and he went to China, in fact, and you may remember the story. He died there, and they've got a great memorial to him in China now. But at that time, he was doing tremendous amount of blood transfusion and saving many lives on the front.
How were you welcomed at the International Brigade?
Very well. Very well indeed we were welcomed by them. And our first assignment after that was to go up to the Sierra Guadarramas in the hills there was a battle taking place then. They were trying to break through to Segovia. And I was in a small hospital there, helping the hospital at the time. And there was quite a lot of wounded came down from that tomb.
What work were you actually doing at the hospital?
Oh, I was doing what really amounted to nursing and in the wards. That's what I was doing at the time.
Where was the hospital?
At Navasarada. It was just a hospital for a small place it was. And the following that, we went to Brunetti.
Do you know when that would have been?
July 1937. And at Brunetti was really a tough assignment because I was, for a short period, I was in the hospital. What was the name of the hospital? I can't remember the name of it, but it doesn't matter. And then they asked me to, Chrome and said, and Dubois, who was head of the whole medical unit, came and said, Roderick, we're sending you out to the front. We want you to take over from a man, Bulka, Dr. Bulka he was. And we want you to take over the ambulance station up there in the front. So I went away out to do that. And I was there for about 3 weeks or more. It was a pretty nasty time, too.
In what way?
It was the amount of attacks that were being mounted upon us and the amount of rifle and shell fire and bombing that went on. And the final attack on us was an attempt to break the line completely. And I remember the day they sent over the Italian Caperoni bombers, and they came over, it seemed to me, in clouds. Huge things, flying low, because the Republic didn't have the necessary flyers or aeroplanes to combat them. And they appeared, came low, and they bombed. I thought we'd had it that day. They were going up in the air like limbs and heads and whatnot. It was a pretty tight affair.
Were any of them brought down, do you know?
Yes, one or two were. There was one or two, but most of them not. It was only... And the place, the bombing, it was so black, finally, with the amount of bombing that was going on. So we had to pull back. Chrome and I were the last people out of that place. And we had to pull back. Not very far, I may say, but we had to. And we got back, and he took me with them to the general's headquarters. General Walters. And we went there, and Chrome went in to see him, and then Walter promoted me at that time to be lieutenant. I was promoted in the field. And for my work on that front. Years and years later, in 40 years later, I went to Poland, and we had the name of a Polish friend of ours here whose son...
Whose one?
Whose son had been lost He had thought he was dead, in fact. And one night, he was lying in bed here in his flat in Glasgow with his wife, when the phone went about 1 o'clock. And he crossly, he was telling us about this, our friend. He crossly said, "Who has phoned me this time?" And the voice of the other said, "It is your son, Andre." "My son," he said, "died in the concentration camps." And the voice said, "At times I wished I had died, but I haven't. I am your son, Andrew." And they went across to see him after that. But here we were in Warsaw, and he was in quite a good position in the tourist, head of the tourist industry in Poland.
This is General Walters?
No, this Andrew, this chap. And we went to see him, and he said, well, amongst other things, he said, "What do you wish to go and see?" I said, "Well, I wish to go and visit the grave of General Walters." He looked quite astonished. "Well," he said, "I have had many requests, pardon me, but never one of that kind. But do you know who he is?" I said, "Yes." I said, he was, he said, "before he was killed, your Minister of Defence, yes, and he's a hero of the Polish, of Poland, who is, he's, I said, his picture is on every Zloty note." He said, "That's right." He said, "I will take you there tomorrow." So the next day, Louise and I and Andrew went away to this huge military cemetery in Warsaw. And we finally found the grave. And there were the names of, there was General Walters' grave, and all the battles he had fought in Spain. Brunete, Jarama, the Belchite, Teruel, before he went back. He was at that time, of course, like many's another in Europe. He was a Jew, had no nationality, there were no nation anyway. And at that time, of course, Poland was anti-Jewish. I think he was, at that time, he was in the Russian army. And he led the Polish contingent in the 41-45 war. And that was General Walter, anyway.
But you actually met him in Spain?
Oh, yes.
Just on that one occasion?
Yes.
What impression did you get of him?
Oh, a very fine soldier, calm, not bigoted, not disturbed by events at all, and very, very proud of, on that occasion, of the way that his troops had behaved, both the Spanish and the British and the international beginners. They had a terrible time because they were trying to break through to relieve Madrid completely. And of course, as usual, they could get so far, and then the ammunition and the tanks and everything else, there weren't enough of them to deal with the situation. And he was so proud of the way that his troops had attacked and had held the enemy, and they had fought them to a standstill at Brunete. They made very little progress in Brunete at all. They made a few miles, but not much. And he was a man of great mental, I think, as well as military skills.
Where did you go to after Brunetti?
Well, after Brunetti, we went away up to the Northern Front. To the Northern Front at... we went round to the Zaragoza front, where that front had been inactive almost from the beginning of the war. It had been mostly anarchist units were up there, and I must say that most of them were just not very active on that front at all.
Do you know when it was that you went there?
Yes, about August and September of 1937.
And was it as you found it, as you expected, that front?
Inactive. Yes, well, we attacked Belchite and took Belchite. But we didn't get very much farther than that. That's where I remember Tom Wintering was there. He was wounded in that front, and Dubois. I think that was where Dubois was killed. Almost certain that's where he was killed. Who was head of the Chrome, I think, took over after he was killed. Dubois was French, and Dubois could never pronounce my name properly. So there was a track that we had in the there at the time. It was called a Matford, so he called me Matford.
Did you know Tom Wintringham? Did you get to know him very well?
No, I didn't know him. I just saw him coming down. I was passing the time. He was wounded.
How closely were you personally associated with the attack on Belchite?
Well, quite closely associated, because we were quite close up to the troops of the attacking force all the time. We were in with them as they were taking the place.
What did you see of the capture?
We had a dreadful... there was enormous amount of slaughter of the enemy in the Belchite itself.